Solar as an investment class is more attractive than ever before across all market segments and for big investors, and then green bonds and then build back better. And so this bigger narrative, I think solar is going to emerge from COVID stronger and better than ever.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics for the benefit of the people and the planet.
My name is Doreen, and I have two of the most known experts in the solar industry on the podcast today. It is Jonathan Gifford, who is the editor-in-chief of PV Magazine, and Mark Osborne, who is the senior news editor of PV Tech. We talk about how 2020 turned out for the solar industry, what to expect in 2021, what trends to look forward to, and generally, how is the industry and the companies equipped in terms of marketing and communication. First of all, thank you both for taking the time. I would have loved to see you for a beer. It hasn't happened this year, hopefully next year. And so this is the reason why we have to catch up on our podcast, which is great. So welcome, Mark. Welcome, John.
Hi.
Happy to have you. My first question is, although both of you look stunning, you've been veterans in the industry, or you are. You've seen the ups and downs. You've seen a lot. What place is the solar industry in right now? What has changed this year?
Age before beauty. Mark, I'll let you have that one.
No, I appreciate it. This year, COVID has obviously had an effect. It's interesting because just if you look at, say, publicly listed inverter manufacturers, because there's some obviously China and there's some Western ones like SMA and Enphase and SolarEdge. And in the first quarter, their sales were up. Second quarter, all of the Western companies' sales were down. That's the impact that COVID then had in second quarter. But of course, the Chinese, who were down in the first quarter because of the impact, bounced right back in the second quarter. And since then, everyone has carried on. So third quarter results all prove that everything is back to normal. The market's open and they're all selling.
Jonathan?
Yeah, look, that's a really good summary from Mark. He's absolutely spot on with the vast majority of that. So, you know, 2020, the latest figures, it depends where you're sourcing them from, but, you know, something like 125 gigawatts or something installed this year, which is pretty remarkable, to be honest. And just like Mark was saying, you know, we did going into this kind of January and more so February, March, we were looking at serious supply constraints on the back of the disruption to the Chinese manufacturers. But it was remarkable how quickly they were able to get production back up and running. And we really didn't see the supply constraints in any real sense that were anticipated. You know, certain producers, certain products, certain market segments, there were some bottlenecks. But exactly as Mark said, I think what's had more of an impact is certain material shortages. You know, these polysilicon explosions certainly don't help things. And these are big, complicated pieces of machinery to get back up running. And then, you know, the latter part of this year, again, as Mark said, this glass shortage is really one of the most serious constraints. But that's on the supply side. On the demand side, it's been really patchy, the impacts of COVID, I would say. So it's really been non-uniform. But as on the whole, solar has proven to be incredibly resilient as an investment, both in the utility scale, but then also distributed. We've heard the same reports about the commercial and industrial segment has been more disrupted, which you can understand as businesses, small and medium and large-sized businesses, defer investment decisions that they might otherwise have taken in light of the uncertainty in the global economy. But the resi segment has been pretty resilient. And there has been a kind of narrative, you know, I track the Aussie market pretty closely. And, you know, going into it, we surveyed a lot of installers and spoke to a lot of installers, and they saw a short-term drop-off in inquiries, some cancellations, and a kind of stalling of demand. But then that bounced back incredibly quickly. And it kind of makes sense. You know, in Australia, we're also hearing about paint manufacturers. You know, they couldn't get enough pigment to produce enough paint because everyone was stuck at home painting their bloody houses and getting around to those jobs that may have been on their list for ages and ages. And it seems like solar is one of those items. So, you know, the Australian residential market's looking at over, you know, 3.2 gigawatts this year, which is just remarkable. But that's kind of small scale rooftop, that sub 100 kilowatt peak system. So it's some small and commercial and industrial in there as well. But then, like, looking at global markets more generally, China will be slightly down on what was expected. Europe is going to do better, something like, you know, 27 gig or something like that. And going into COVID, more like 20 was being expected by a lot of analysts. But even within Europe, that's a little bit patchy as well. Some projects have been delayed, and Spain looks like it got hit much harder than anyone else. The USA looks like it's going to come in exactly what we're expecting before COVID hit. But the biggest impact has really been in India, from what we're seeing, where something like 13 gigawatt was expected, but it looks like only five or so will be installed this year. So India's probably been hit hardest in terms of global markets.
How much has it actually hurt the companies that Intersolar or PVSEC or something didn't happen, and they didn't meet in person, and they couldn't go through the halls and, you know, look at the latest technologies?
I would say that the major events in particular have had an impact, a negative impact, not happening. I think the industry overly dependent on major events as an issue. What that has led to, obviously, is the likes of us having to react. And Jonathan's no different. We've had to react to engaging with our audiences on behalf of our advertisers and doing things like webinars that attracts the audience that they once used to attract at the events. That's no question. That's been a massive difference to our business model this year. I would also say a lot of companies marketing as a dependence on events is because of poor marketing, is that they've not pursued really good marketing campaigns because they've relied too heavily on the events that people would just turn up and hand a business card. And I think they've learned now that maybe there's a mix. Maybe, you know, the likes of Intersolar, which has been probably my favorite event to attend. So I've missed that. I've missed going to Munich, and the venue is one of the best venues. It is one of the best venues. It's centered, it's localized. And even when I go back when the 13 halls were used in the big days, even now, it's still one of the best venues. SNEC is a nightmare to attend. I don't think that will ever change. It needs to be like a week, but we probably wouldn't survive a week. But it needs to be, because you cannot do what you need to do there in a couple of days. But yeah, my take is companies are going to combine the two, as in, you know, they're going to be more selective on the events that they do travel to because of the hassles, and also, you know, still do the webinar side of things because they've realized this is something they've missed out doing. They're getting the feedback that this is a good thing. That's a big change, I think, for the media side. And I don't think I would argue that going to less events is a bad thing. Given the number of events that we could have gone to, it's good to be able to back off a bit.
So in a way, it's good actually that this happened for companies to realize they need to really boost up their communication and marketing activities and not just rely on Intersolar or SNEC and some people come to their booth, but really tell the story and do it right. So what do you think they still need to learn, Jonathan? Where do you think there is still a lack in the industry from your point of view? Because you're obviously getting all the press releases and everything.
Well, what do they need to learn? I don't think that digital events will, in the short or medium term, in any case, completely replace face-to-face events. I think, as Mark was saying, there will always be a need for these kind of tentpole events or some big ones. But I agree with him once again that hopefully we can see this proliferation of very small events. Hopefully there'll be some consolidation there, which I think is good for everyone's marketing budgets and everyone's time and sleep pattern. And also for the carbon footprint of our industry as well, which, you know, just is unsustainable having people flying all over the world. But I think that might be also a little bit part of the kind of natural progression or evolution of the solar industry from quite a small niche, very segmented, geographically diverse, people chasing high feed-in tariff schemes that are short-lived and very opportunistic in that way, to much more kind of long-term, sustainable, long-term engagement with a market. But going back to your question, what do companies need? I don't think it's uniform. I think it's very different. I think some companies are very good at telling their story and engaging with people like Mark and myself and PV Tech and PV Magazine and other platforms, engaging with us in a meaningful, ongoing way to build an audience and to develop that relationship with the community. And others are just not. So it's a real mixed bag. But I would say that one quite refreshing thing that I've really been seeing in the last 1 or 2 years is that a lot of the Chinese players who are so crucial to our industry are really developing much more sophistication in their ability to communicate in a way that resonates with, you know, inverted commas, Western markets, I suppose. There's a lot of increase in the sophistication there. And I think that's a good thing, having this conversation with the industry, being more open and transparent and really sharing information.
Do you feel like they're putting much more effort in this than the Western solar companies?
You know, effort and money are two different things. But, you know, I think LONGi is a really good example of that. They've been so influential in the industry in a technology sense and execution sense, but they were also really engaging in terms of communication in a really positive way. And I think they're telling a really good story. They have a good story to tell and they do it well. So I think that's a good example.
Yeah, I think there have been companies like LONGi, as Jonathan says. I think if we take the top 10 sort of PV manufacturers, most of them are actually good communicators. A few are less so, but the majority are pretty good. I think a lot of the industry, though, is pretty poor. And I think it's not moved on. If we go back, Jonathan, like 10 years, you know, there's a lot of companies that are still in business, but we don't hear from them from one year to the next. They're not announcing anything. You have to go, not that I'm bothered, but we have to go and find something, especially if they're still like publicly listed. You know, you have to go and dig in and see if there's a story somewhere.
You do very well.
Yeah, that's old school journalism for you. But I think the industry is not good at the overall. I mean, that's from marketing in general to PR. It has not been the strong point of this industry.
What is missing and what do you think is not good? I mean, besides the top 10, let's say, who do a good job.
What's been part of the problem is that companies have a perception of what is news. Someone's not teaching them or educating them as to what is news. So they will pump out a lot of information, but it's not news. That hasn't really changed in 10 years. Other companies, as I said, that used to pump out news, pump out less news and more just information, propaganda. So there's been a shift from different companies, but actually the overall quality is still, like, compared to, say, the semiconductor industry, 10 years behind, you know, as far as the quality of the content that they're coming out with. The industry's still got a lot to learn.
Can I ask you something? Because last week I talked to Brent Goff, who's the main news anchor of Deutsche Welle, and he basically said, because German companies, for example, still send a lot of press releases, but overall, worldwide, he sees a decline. And actually, he says they don't even look at it anymore. They just on social, on Twitter and elsewhere. And this is where they get the news. And if it's interesting enough, they dig or they request more information. Is that how it works with you guys too? Or you still look at press releases and are they still important for you?
No, I would say they are. I think a public service broadcaster is slightly different position to trade media organizations like ourselves. So I think press releases are important. And I've always said they're also kind of important as historical documents. You know, they chart the evolution of a company and they're important to that extent. But in terms of just going back to what we were talking about and what might perhaps be lacking, from my side, it's kind of the broader narrative. What is the story that's being told, both within the solar industry, but also outside of the industry? And I think a lot of companies have a bit of short-termism in terms of what they'll say. This is what we see as being the strategic value of our product today, and we want to talk about that, and that's what we want to talk about. I don't think that's that effective. I think it's more effective creating a broader narrative that's going to run over numerous quarters and that's going to inform this perception, not only of solar for their customers, but solar for the whole economy. And now that we are stepping up into the main stage, I think those narratives are important.
Yeah, I totally agree, because a lot of companies just want to tell their story no matter what. And what they don't look at is, what do their customers actually want? What is my value here? You know, what do they want? What are their problems? What are their worries? How can I address that? Most companies don't. They're just saying, okay, I just want to market my product, and don't realize that nobody wants to hear that, actually.
Yes. And how does that relate to the discussion that's being had within the industry at the moment? You know, if they're out shouting about something that no one cares about, why the hell are you shouting?
Exactly. Good point. So a little bit back to the whole Europe-China topic we've touched on a little bit. We see kind of a resurrection, or there's been talk about a resurrection of solar, let's say in Germany with Meyer Burger starting production. There is Oxford PV, kind of a few players around. Do you see that as well? Do you see that Europe is coming back up, or is it just a temporary phase that we're seeing?
Some people have called it like a renaissance. I think that's okay. I don't think that's overplaying it. I think regardless of yet the impact that we've yet to see about the Green New Deal in Europe, I think it's basically been the cost of solar continues to go down. It never goes back up. This is electronics industry. Therefore, it will scale and it does continue to fall. So we've passed it. We're at that grid parity point. We're below it in some countries. And Europe, at the end of the day, utilities have to pick solar. It's at the lowest cost. And so there's no issue. And again, the COVID issue could accelerate all of this coming through. So the renaissance is there. I think it's real. I think it's basically driven by costs. The costs are just so further down, aggressively come down, and they're going to continue aggressively to come down. There's the natural thing about Europe. And as a mature Western economy, you know, we haven't even talked about electric vehicles yet, but that was always going to be a huge driver. Instead of phases of, say, energy conservation, as in, you know, cost-cutting measures, you know, insulating your homes, you know, reducing your heating bills, all of that is great stuff. But we're just going to enter another phase where demand for electricity because of EV will go through the roof. And we're the difference this time is you don't build coal-fired power stations. You won't build nuclear power stations. In Europe, I think this is part of what solar does. It constantly drives the cost down of electricity. And that's why you're seeing the renaissance. We're going to see that. And China, you know, have had 2 years of really underperforming. You know, this is policy. This was literally project developers' knees were cut off, basically, 2 years ago. But now they've got the new five-year plan, which is very much, you might as well add in, as far as renewables are concerned, that is a Green New Deal. And now you're going to see that skyrocket. It's got to be a 100-gigawatt market.
Jonathan, how do you see this value chain building up in Europe? Is that going to last? Is it important? How do you see that?
It's a tricky question a little bit because it's hard. So making solar cells and modules is really hard. Well, no, not making them is hard. Making them and making any money.
Making them efficiently.
Yeah, like if you look at the disruption within the ranks of solar manufacturing over the last 10 years, it's just, you know, there's corpses everywhere from major manufacturers. You know, the top 10 ranking is pretty dynamic over the last 10 years. It's just the big guys tend to get big and then fall over. But it's just a really hard business. And I think it's really ambitious of Meyer Burger. And I think it's a good thing. You know, energy is a strategic good. And for Europe to be able to supply some of this huge demand that is coming for solar products, it's here already, but it's only going to grow, as Mark says. I think to be able to produce that on the continent within the EU is a good thing. And we can't forget that there's really good technology and research taking place in Europe. And for those in solar and for those research institutes to be able to industrialize the technology with these established, in particular, German production equipment suppliers, although there is a really vibrant community, or there was, of production equipment suppliers in Europe. And for them to be able to work kind of hand in glove with the research institutes and then a manufacturer or a number, because there's also REC is looking to develop, you know, a 2-gigawatt factory in France. So yeah, for cell production to come back to Europe, I think is generally a good thing for the development of the EU or solar in the EU, for the development of solar technology, because these innovations will go into factories much more quickly and transparently, I would say, because a lot of what goes on within Chinese technological developments within solar is somewhat opaque, you can say. But it's going to be tough. As Mark said, the prices are only going to go one way. And if you're making a niche product that's too expensive, you're not going to survive.
But I mean, we need it because we have the whole hydrogen topic now. Europe wants to be the lead, or will probably, from a technology point of view, even leading in the hydrogen area. And I mean, the only way hydrogen is going to go is green. You know, we don't have to start with blue or anything else. For that, we need way, way more solar, even wind. So the question is also, I mean, doesn't China need their own production for their own market? You know, like in a way that there's not even that much left for the other markets? Or do you see them still being the leading players in the future?
The Chinese solar manufacturers are ramping and announcing capacity expansion plans that clearly show that they're more than capable of meeting 100 plus gigawatt of demand just in China and meet the rest of the world demand. And that's what the likes of Meyer Burger and REC are facing, is that kind of huge, huge gigawatts expansions. You know, the likes of Trina are going to be at 30 gigawatts next year. So when people say, oh, we're going to build a 1 gigawatt plant, it doesn't matter. It's not to the scale that is really needed. Obviously, what's lacking in Europe from the manufacturing side is simply the policies as part of a Green New Deal. You know, we've had the Green New Deal, but there's nothing in it that says how that will happen. You know, how are you going to support local manufacturing? And the thing is as well, it's not about just the jobs. It does make economic sense that, you know, if you've got a, for argument's sake, if we say by 2030, Europe becomes more than 100, 200 gigawatt market a year because of electric vehicles, hydrogen, energy demand. You really want to be putting that on containers, on shipping, you know, and 3/4 of the way around the world. It doesn't make sense. And the product is large, you know, so you don't really want to do that. At scale, as demand happens in Europe, you really want to have localized manufacturing, purely from then the carbon footprint issue, but it's also a logistics issue. You want that supply right where it's needed.
And geopolitically as well. You don't want to be, if you're importing 200 gigawatts of modules, you know, by 2030 or 100 or whatever, you know, some enormous number, you don't want to be reliant on one trading partner. This is energy still.
Besides that, isn't it important to also keep some technology here? And what do you think? Do you think there should be policies that support the production of solar in Europe in order to get it back up to a level, you know, where it used to be, or at least so that we can, you know, levelize with China?
Okay. It's been pretty proven that if government or, say, the EU as an entity pushes a particular agenda on R&D, it will fall over. Do you leave that to the market? No, I think it is a collaboration between the two. That's proven to work. But as Jonathan said, the dilemma at the moment for Europe is the R&D facilities are excellent. They are, you know, ranked right up there with the likes of University of New South Wales. The US has pretty much fallen away. NREL's policy actually dictated to them was to move away from solar, go and look at grid support. So NREL's position in solar from an R&D perspective is very much at the downstream market, not in the upstream anymore. So Europe is a major hub for R&D. What it needs is the manufacturing that then works with them, that co-fund the R&D that they need to do for the next generation of solar cells. And again, you have to say, well, is that going to be part of, you know, an update to the Green New Deal that Europe has signed up to or is expected to, because there's nothing in there for solar. Yeah, there's nothing in there at the moment that says where that manufacturing is sustainable, where the R&D can be sustained because of the manufacturing. So when we see Meyer Burger come in, all good. That shows a commitment that I think they believe, certainly even in an early period, they don't need that kind of policy support, whether that's a carbon footprint tax or not.
Do people or customers look at where the module is coming from? What's the quality of the module? What is the technology behind it? Yeah, does it really matter or is it a pure price decision?
10 years ago, there was definitely a group, whether it was utility scale people, but residential in particular, though there was a group of people very, very conscious about the carbon footprint. What is this technology? Where does it come from? And you can put those down as early adopters anywhere in the world, you know, America included. I think that kind of thing disappeared to a certain degree. And I think it is coming back because of the scale. Yeah, because of the size of the industry, you are seeing project developers look at the carbon footprint issue. Because if you look at where they're getting the money from, it's investment companies, it's teachers' pension funds. They are dictating a lot more than they have done in the past, where they want to identify those with the lowest carbon footprint, or they want to use a particular technology, they want to use particular companies because they've done the due diligence on them. And I think First Solar's done incredibly well under that envelope, especially in America. But again, you come to Europe, I think this whole thing of the carbon footprint is a way of balancing supply and demand as we get into like the scenario over the next 10 years of 100 plus gigawatts a year being installed in Europe, you have to have those kind of policies in place or restrictions on footprint. People have to be more aware of that.
I think the awareness isn't there, but France is, I think, the only country that has that policy, yeah. Right?
It got watered down from what it was originally going to be. But yes, they still have. I think that's the hope. If you look at the EU, they've been very scared at putting in anything like this because of retaliation by China. But that kind of basic carbon footprint element, I think, can work. It makes sense. It's like no one's trying to put barriers up. What it does is it's educating everybody that it's crazy to ship, you know, hundreds of gigawatts halfway around the world on container ships. And yes, you will probably need some of that. That's fine. Or those kind of major companies, the likes of Jinko, you know, who's the largest producer at the moment, and Trina's definitely trying to beat them. These two companies could easily end up, although the supply chain will have to improve for this, but could easily end up building gigawatt plants in Europe, you know, because they understand that carbon footprint element. And one way of meeting the part of that carbon footprint would be localized manufacturing, as we said earlier. It just makes sense anyway. You know, it's not trying to put a barrier or pretend that carbon footprint policy is some form of barrier. We actually would need that. It would be silly not to have it.
Jonathan, is there something like a premium versus mass market, you know, like we see in fashion or any other industry, the car industry, we have that, you know, that we have sustainable and fair products that are kind of the Mercedes. And then we have like the mass products that nobody expects much from and last much long and, you know, kind of throw away, although policies should take place in that category. But do you think we'll see something like that in the solar industry?
Yeah, we already have it to some extent, like on a performance basis with modules. So there are the LGs and the SunPower high efficiency modules, and they do and they can charge a premium, and then tiers underneath that, you know, there's a whole wide range. But in terms of that being informed by sustainability, I don't think that really we see that at the moment. But I think that it's inevitable that it will happen, you know, and there's programs in the US now. So there's the EPAT system introduced by the Green Electronics Council. And so that's kind of going to be a way, a certification system whereby buyers will be able to demand a certain level of certification in terms of sustainability and workplace practices and these kind of things. And as Mark said, these institutional investors are going to demand it. So the question is, which kind of pathway we'll go down? Will it be one whereby the investors are demanding a certain level of certification and therefore that will inform green practices within the manufacturing of solar components? Or will it come the other way in terms of a carbon tax and therefore it will just price kind of dirty module or the module that are less efficiently, kind of will price them out of the market? So I think it'll be a bit of both. It'll be horses for courses in different markets.
What kind of policies do you think we need in the next few years in order to, you know, get solar to where it should be, to grow much more and to really make sure that we have enough solar energy for the hydrogen, for the electromobility? What do we need? Or is it just a market-driven thing?
Yeah, get out of the way. Let us do our job. In Europe, carbon pricing has been really effective in recent years. And as it goes up, we just see coal becomes increasingly uncompetitive.
I mean, in Germany, for example, there are calls, right? You may be a bit nearer to Johnson from various parties to really put it back into the EEG, the feed-in tariff, and to really make sure we ensure a build-up of renewables, whether it's solar or wind, doesn't really matter right now. Or should this be implemented by other countries as well? Like, should there be something like a global EEG or like a European EEG, something like that? Nobody sees the effects right now of the Green Deal.
I think we need to create the conditions by which solar can get on and do its job. And those conditions are retiring existing polluting assets, getting out of coal, accelerating their end of life, and then also building the grid infrastructure that's required to allow solar to go in. And so, like, when we look at Australia, we've seen that solar is incredibly competitive. These old coal clunkers are retiring, they're falling over and not being able to do their job, but we can't install the solar because the grid's too bloody weak. You need the infrastructure. And I think the grid plays an important role. So the grid has to be strong enough. We have to work out how we can balance the grid as these thermal generators retire. And that means energy storage and batteries. And the developers need to be able to access the grid. So renewable in Australia, renewable energy zones are being pursued by a number of states. And it looks like a really effective way to bolster the grid in the right areas. Let us deploy the solar and get the power where it needs to go.
Yeah, I totally agree. And to be honest, the technology is all there. What Jonathan's been talking about is all there. The grid technology is there for this. The energy storage, even hydrogen will be there for this. There's nothing technologically that prevents any of this. And so the bottom line is all that solar really needs, it's got its own roadmap. It knows where it's going. The technology doesn't have to be reinvented. A lot of people say, you know, you see mainstream press will pick up on perovskite material and say, this is the revolutionary new material. We don't need it. Thank you very much. It's great, but it's not revolutionary and will get adopted somewhere down the line when it's ready. So nothing has to be reinvented. It's all there. And I think maybe that's the scary part for industry like coal industry or governments that are very dependent on fossil fuels is they're just scared of what these renewable technologies can actually do and have done so rapidly. And none of that is slowing down. So I think we don't need much. The grid, yes, absolutely. The grid has to be worked on. To a degree, we're seeing that. But if you look about really globally, then yeah, the grid's probably the weakest link. Most grids are 100 years old, you know, with large populations. So that has to change. But hey, that's a great part of a Green New Plan because it's labor intensive, it's engineering, it's construction. So there's lots of different materials being used for that. But I don't think the industry has really bothered or worried about, oh, we need anything. This industry's been very independent because of, you know, the hostility to it primarily. Even in Germany, I would say there's still that reticence about solar. In the UK, we've dropped all support for residential solar just when everybody wants to do their part, you know, for green energy. But that will come back because, again, the pricing will come down to the point where people will just pick it regardless of any policy that supports it. And that's another thing people have to sort of get their heads around. So I'm not sure what policies really work. I think that the Green New Deal side, some kind of carbon footprint, I don't want to bore myself with talking on that, but something just as a facilitator, because the technology is there. It doesn't need to be huge R&D investments. That can be done by the industry. It's doing it anyway. So it's just a matter of scaling that up, just like their manufacturing.
One more question. We talked a lot about modules, right? But I mean, there's more to that, the trackers, inverters, et cetera. Now, I think the industry has moved on massively because they didn't really matter. Nobody really cared about it 10, 15 years ago. Now they do play a role and it matters which one are you using. How do you see the components market in the solar industry? How important is it for the working of, let's say, even large scale plant? And there have been also some, I would say, wars going on, especially in the tracker industry with some big players. How do we see that developing? Where do you see 2021 in that?
I think the really briefly on it, both the tracker guys and the inverter guys are really being impacted by the larger wafers and therefore the larger module sizes. So their whole business models, from a point of the technology, totally changing, have to change if they want to stay in business with trackers. The inverter companies, if they want to supply utility, which of course they do because that's the big money, it's the lowest level of profit, it's the high revenues, the turnover, it's the capacity side of it that they need. Again, they have to come up with new inverters that match the needs of the larger modules. And that's what's happening. So you're seeing sort of fighting going on, but actually it's a mad dash to get up to date with what 2021 and beyond is for utility. It's going to be large area modules. You're going to need different trackers, and all of these are coming through. And the inverters are lagging a little bit behind on that. So, for instance, the 182 millimeter wafer size and the modules, therefore, with that, they can still use existing string inverters, central inverters. The 210 millimeter wafer guys with the larger modules, they're a little bit behind for having the right type of inverters for them to come through. They'll come through sometime next year. So I think there's a mad dash with inverter companies and tracker companies to be relevant and, you know, provide what they've been providing before for the future.
Do you think they all survive, Johnson?
Will they all survive? It's so easy to predict consolidation because over the long term, you're always right. But yeah, surely there'll be some consolidation. I've been hearing a bit about some more kind of vertical integration that some of these, you know, BOS, balance of systems, if you use a very broad catch-all definition of that, there might be some more vertical integration. And like Mark was saying, in the short term, there'll be this huge focus on these large wafers and module sizes. And maybe that will drive some more integration because they have to work more closely to achieve this innovation in a short period of time. I heard Dean Solon from Shoals the other day say, oh, we're all jumping off a cliff with these big wafer and module sizes, and we don't know yet whether there's going to be water or glass at the bottom. And I think that's not a bad description, but I think it's going to happen and the industry is going to have to take it in their stride. One development in the BOS space that I've been kind of interested in is kind of software solutions. I think we're getting a bit smarter there. And I've seen some quite exciting stuff out there just in terms of more advanced monitoring, right down to monitoring during installation, cleaning robots and all of that stuff. Just getting more data from what's going on in the PV system and being able to control it better as well. So I think there's some innovation happening there. And perhaps we'll see a move towards pre-assembly more, but that's more down the track, maybe. We're still doing
sector or for the large utility scale?
No, for utility scale, I think. I know people have tried it for the rooftop, but more in the rooftops projects are more just bespoke, I suppose. Utility is potentially where it could be really powerful because we are doing a lot of assembly on the field and we know that a lot of quality issues are incurred when you have people installing modules by hand. And these big modules, man, they're going to be difficult to install by hand. So, you know, whether we'll see an increase in pre-installed or prefabrication, I think that could be likely. We might see parts of a row or something can't get shipped on site pre-installed, and that will speed up deployment and also increase quality. It's hard to know exactly, but the short-term trend, exactly as Mark said, is just these big modules, big wafers, big modules, coping with those. That's the immediate hurdle that needs to be overcome.
Thank you so much, both of you. I think it was a fantastic talk. It was a good review and a good outlook for 2021. And the one thing I think I agree with is that the industry is strong and I think can only get better.
Yeah, and me and Jonathan didn't fight over anything. That's remarkable.
We agreed way too much.
Yeah, I think we were being too nice to you.
Okay, next year we're going to have a few disputes again.
No, but yeah. I've built my career on just copying what Mark says. Why change now?
Thanks, guys. It was good.
A pleasure. Yeah. Thank you, Doreen.
Thank you. See you, guys.
Cheers, guys. Good to see you. Bye. Great to see you, Marky. Look after yourself.
Thank you, mate.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international cleantech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.